David Plotz is an editor and a reporter at Slate.com, which requires him to be well-versed in politics and literature. But because, as he says, he's always been a proud Jew but never an observant one, he realized in 2006 that he knew next to nothing about the Hebrew Bible, the basis of his religion. So he decided to remedy the situation by reading it from cover to cover in 1 year. He blogged about that experience on Slate, and now those entries have been published under the title The Good Book, The Bizarre, Hilarious, Disturbing, Marvelous, and Inspiring Things I Learned When I Read Every Single Word of the Bible. It's from HarperCollins, and I'm pleased it has brought David Plotz to the show today. Hello.
Hi.
I'm assuming that you didn't read it in Hebrew and Aramaic. Did you read the King James Version, or is there an official Jewish translation?
Oh, I did not read it in Hebrew. My Hebrew was enough to get me through a Reform bar mitzvah.
And I'm really shaky on Aramaic.
My Aramaic is very solid, but I didn't do that. I read the Jewish Publication Society's Tanakh, which is a great translation, and then I also read some of the King James and another Christian translation too.
And do you think that do they diverge a bit? I mean, well, what would have happened if you had read it in the original? Do you think you would have gotten something else out of it?
I would have gotten a lot more out of it. I would have, you know, everyone who talks about this says, I got hundreds of emails saying, how can you read this in English? You can't possibly be getting the real meaning of this. And, you know, my answer is I didn't have the 6 or 10 years it would require to bone up on my biblical Hebrew to get through it. But I'm sure it's much, much richer. And I think one of the things that you do get in translation is that translation gives you words that you have meanings for. And apparently there's lots of words in the Bible that people just don't really exactly know what they mean. And so the translation is very inexact for lots of the Bible. Job in particular is famously hard to decipher.
So we may very well have a distorted view of what the original intent of the writers was?
I think that's almost certainly true. There's a great example of this is there's a moment where the Philistines all get hemorrhoids from the Ark. They steal the Ark of the Covenant, or they capture the Ark of the Covenant, and they get hemorrhoids from having the Ark of the Covenant. And then they return the Ark of the Covenant, and they send 5 gold hemorrhoids as a sort of atonement offering to the Israelites. And you read it, and you're like, what is a gold hemorrhoid? And you know, the new thinking is actually these are phalluses, that this is actually some kind of erectile dysfunction, not hemorrhoids that they're getting. But the language is very confusing, so no one's really sure.
What was your goal here? You say that it was to find out what happens when an ignorant person actually reads the book on which his religion is based. Now, this is false modesty, or do you mean ignorant only of religion?
Well, I think, you know, to be ignorant of the Bible is to be ignorant a lot of your culture. And I had a Sunday school understanding of the Bible. I'd been bar mitzvahed. I was circumcised. I went to a Christian high school where I took Bible classes. But my understanding of the Bible was really at the level that you get in the popular culture and at the occasional visit to synagogue. And that's a pretty spare understanding of the book. And that the book, when you get it that way, the book is very clear. There are morals that are you're given stories with morals in them. God is presented as this very understanding and compassionate God. The heroes are very heroic. And then you actually start to read the book yourself, and you realize that it's nowhere near as simple as what you've been taught or as what I've been taught. That the Sunday school Bible doesn't really have much to do with what I call the messy Bible.
So they've expurgated the Bible to get rid of all of the parts that might upset people?
They haven't gotten rid of all of the parts. And there's not a plot. I see it as a plot. But I think if you're going to use this as a foundation of, you know, Judaism or Christianity, there's confusion in lots of the stories that you have. For example, in the story of Jacob and Esau, Jacob comes down to us as our hero. Jacob is the patriarch. He is Israel. He is the father of my people. Yet, when you look at the story of Jacob and Esau, the twin brother whom he steals the blessing from, Esau is the one you would say is the moral one. Esau is sweet and forgiving and kind. And Jacob is a con artist who is just scheming and tricking his brother out of something. But yet Jacob is our father. So we have to sort of do some work to get an appealing character there.
And you named your son Jacob, not Esau.
I named my son Jacob before I'd read the Bible. I regretted it. I have a new son, my third child, who was born after I'd read the Bible. And I gave him a the name Gideon, because Gideon was one of these biblical heroes, these people who came to me. I thought, this is when I read about the story of Gideon, I thought, this is the kind of man I'd like my son to grow up to be.
Isn't part of the Jewish tradition to read all of the commentaries along with the original text?
It is.
Because of these confusions?
It is, absolutely.
Did you do that?
I did not. This is a very un-Jewish way to read the Bible. It's a very sort of evangelical Christian way to read the Bible, actually, to read it by yourself.
Although we are not calling it the Old Testament. That is the name that Christians give to the book that you're talking about.
Right. That's fine. You can call it the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible or the Tanakh. Any of those works.
You blogged on Slate.com about reading the book. What was the response like?
The response was extraordinary. I got 11,000 emails when I, at last count, from people who wanted to thank me, to correct me, to offer me another interpretation of a story I was doing.
Any offended?
Tons.
Because you were giving a literal reading to this book?
Well, I would say the vast majority of people were not offended. The vast majority of people, in fact, were tolerant. Even people who thought I was wrong, they appreciated that I was giving this a chance. There were sort of atheists who said, why are you giving this book of mythology such a serious treatment? And then there were very seriously religious people of Jewish, both Orthodox Jews and very serious Christians who said, you're a fool and you're going to go to hell.
And you have suggested that it be taught in school. And I would think that would have upset some people, especially people who are concerned about separation of church and state.
Yes, it should upset people who are concerned about separation of church and state. I'm more concerned about the separation of children and knowledge. I think that you have in the Bible the most important book to our culture, without a doubt. Much more important than Shakespeare, even more important than you could argue than the Constitution. As important as anything that we read, and yet there's a ban. And I felt when I read it for the first time that I'd suddenly taken a veil off my culture, that there were all sorts of things I finally understood that I hadn't understood before. And I think that children, there is a way to teach children this in civilization classes, I think.
But would you want to teach the Quran as well and some of the other holy books around the world?
No, I don't think that's required, because I think it's foundational to us because our civilization is built on the Bible. It's not built on the Quran. If you lived in Saudi Arabia or Jordan, then you would say, yes, teach the Quran, which is the foundational document. For us, the foundational document is the Bible.
My guest is David Plotz, who's written a book called Good Book, The Bizarre, Hilarious, Disturbing, Marvelous, and Inspiring Things I Learned When I Read Every Single Word of the Bible. It is published by Harper. So what are some of the things that you learned? We know some of these stories. Some of these stories are very well known. Were you surprised by some of the ones we know well? For example, the story of Abraham and the sacrifice.
That was a story that story didn't surprise me that much, because I think that is a story that has come down to us. That's one of the rare, very difficult Bible stories which actually has come down to us and has remained complex. I think the story about Abraham that really surprised me was this wonderful story about God drops by the tent of Abraham one day and says, oh, I'm off to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah because their sin is so grave. And Abraham waxes indignant and says, how can you, the Lord of all, the distributor of justice, destroy these cities if there are even 50 innocent people living there? And God sort of pauses for a second and says, okay, I won't destroy it if they're 50. And then Abraham says, what if they're 45? And God says, okay, not if they're 45, 40. And Abraham talks him down. And this moment of Abraham, of the human being sort of standing up to his God and demanding justice from God, was to me one of the great moments in the Bible.
And why do you think the writers of the Bible would include that?
Well,
I mean, wasn't this book intended to make people believe in the omnipotence of God?
I think the book is intended to do that. At the same time, the main theme that I saw running through the Hebrew Bible, as opposed to, I think, through what you see in the New Testament, where God is quite loving and compassionate.
Although there are inconsistencies in the New Testament as well, and there are plenty here, you point out.
Right. Well,
we'll get
to that point. But God is not – it's hard to love the God of the Hebrew Bible. It's very hard to love him. But what you realize is that the people who are heroic in the Hebrew Bible tend to be people who are engaged in argument with God, that we're – Jews are, I don't think it's any surprise that Jews are the great lawyers of the world, because fundamentally our religion is about disputation. It's about a God who is being unreasonable or difficult or confusing, and us saying, you know what? I'm not going to stand for this. I'm going to ask about it. I'm going to inquire, or I'm going to dispute, or I'm going to argue, or I'm going to at least have a discussion with you, God. And you see this with Abraham in the story I just told. You see it with Moses. You see it with Gideon. You see it with Job. And those, I do think that the great Jewish contribution to religion is this notion that it's not obedience that is valued. It's questioning. It's doubt. And so I think the story of Abraham is an example of that.
And you say also that clever people are often favored over good people.
Yes.
And that we saw with Jacob and Esau.
We see that with Jacob and Esau. We see that with Jacob's mother, Rebecca, who's sort of this Lady Macbeth-like figure who is incredibly clever and is rewarded. You see it with Abraham, too.
One of the most upsetting stories for people who have not read every word is the story of Dinah.
The story of Dinah, which appears in the middle of Genesis, actually sparked this book for me. I flipped open a Bible at a bat mitzvah and came upon the story. And it's about this daughter of Jacob who goes out and is raped by a young man named Shechem. And Shechem decides he wants to marry her. Long story short, Jacob's brothers say, Shechem, you can marry her, but only if you and all the men of your town get circumcised. So Shechem and all the men of his town get circumcised. At this point, when they're in pain, when they're injured, incapacitated, Jacob's sons show up, kill them all, take their women and children as slaves, and sack their town. And to me, reading this was a horrifying revelation. It's like, here you have rape, you have, you know, using the great covenant of circumcision to trick people into conversion just to slaughter them.
And to kill innocent people, because not everyone raped her.
Only one person raped her, and the others are absolutely innocent. And it's not being done by our enemies. It's being done by us, by our patriarchs. And I read that story and thought, this, you know, they never taught me this at Temple Sinai.
Although people like Christopher Hitchens, your colleague at Slate, is likely to cite something like this when he argues against religion.
Sure. And you know, there's no
well,
shortage.
Do you have any idea why that story? I mean, what is that story supposed to tell us?
I think that story comes back actually later at the end of Genesis. Jacob dispossesses the two sons who led that slaughter, Simeon and Levi, and says, essentially, your anger is too great. And so I think part of the reason for that story is to set us up to have the Simeon and Levi dispossessed, a recognition that what they did was wrong. And part of it is, is that this is a book written by a tribal culture, you know, to explain events that they thought had happened or was happening, and there are terrible things that happened.
And one of those stories involves your namesake, David, the king, and he goes against God and pays a price. But then he decides at the end that he's not going to pray for his son after his son has died.
Right. So after David commits adultery with Bathsheba and fathers a child with her and causes Bathsheba's husband to be killed, God decides David will be punished for this. And the punishment will be that this son dies. And the son, David, while the son is alive, David prays and hopes that the son lives. When the son dies, David gives up and stops praying and gets back to work. And I think that's a very human, majestic moment in the Bible, because you see David realize he has done wrong, that God has punished him, and he deserves it, and yet at the same time that he has an obligation as the king, as a husband and father, to get back to life.
Did you talk to any of the people who are well-versed in the commentaries?
I did after I had, done the blog, which became the foundation for the book. But I didn't want to while I was doing it, because I wanted to have this be sort of an average Job reading this. I didn't want to be guided by the rabbis and the pastors.
Did you say average Job?
I said the average Job, yes.
Well, the book of Job is one of the most moving stories in the Bible. Do you think we understand it completely?
That's a very hard question.
Go ahead. Yeah. We have very little time. So.
I don't know. I mean, it's incredibly hard. To me, Job, God at the end of Job seems to recognize that Job is in fact right, that Job's questioning of God was merited and that Job's friends were wrong. So, But I, you know, the translation apparently is very difficult.
David Plotz's book, Good Book, The Bizarre, Hilarious, Disturbing, Marvelous, and Inspiring Things I Learned When I Read Every Single Word of the Bible, is published by Harper's. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.